My name is Bill, and I'm a real alcoholic and a Texan. God, I got to get that in. I was going to, do the customary stuff that a speaker does when he's asked to talk and say, I'd like to thank Ray Klepper, for the invitation of coming up here and speaking tonight. That idiot's in Red Bluff, and I didn't know that he was living up there. God, I rings yesterday at work, and it's this familiar voice, but it's out of context, you know what I mean? And, I mean, he's not supposed to be calling me there, he's not even supposed to know I work, And he told me who it was, and he says, our speaker flaked out, or he says, I think what he did, he really got honest. He says, I forgot to get a speaker, and he said, would you help me out, And I said, sure, I'd be delighted. I'd love to come up to Stockton and share with the people in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thought I was going to get up here and get a hug from him, and then I get here and find out he's not around. How good does a guy living in Red Bluff arrange speakers for a meeting in Stockton and get a hold of a guy in Fresno to come talk? It just baffles me, but I guess that's a miracle of the program. Anyway, I'd like to thank the Oxford groups the Oxford group of Stockton for the privilege of coming here and sharing for a few minutes with you some of my story. Coming up here, Ray had given me some directions on how to get here, because I really, as many times I've been in Stockton, I'm not, real sure of my way around. And so he'd given me some directions on how to get here, and we pulled up out here at the corner, and I couldn't see the marquee on the front of the church out here because it faces that other street. I found Elmwood, made the turn, came on down, thought I was lost. It's all residential. And all of a sudden, here's cars parked over here on the northwest corner. And I can't see the marquee in the front, so I'm not sure if it's a church or what this is, and pull in there, and I told my wife, I said, do you see any drunk crap around here? Now, excuse my language, but that's what I asked her. I use another word, but because, I'm used to, when I go someplace, you look for bumper stickers and other stuff, and that's how this must be the place, Didn't see any bumper stickers out there. But there were three guys over here talking and hugging, and we knew we was in the right place. You guys. And so there's no question, this is the right place. And so pulled in and parked and hopped out, and Dan comes, first thing I hear is his voice of, what was it, how you doing or something, I hadn't seen you in a while or something, and gosh, get greeted right getting out of the car door. I guess what I'm saying is that, I'm home, feel comfortable any place in Alcoholics Anonymous. Even getting a call from Red Bluff. Ray must have been a little chagrined when he called my home and he started talking to my son. And he thought my son was me. And pretty soon my son caught on and says, wait a minute, I think you want my dad. Oh, where's your dad? He said, well, he's working. He says, oh, well, where does he work? Can I have the phone number? And my son told him, started Ray's day off good, I know. Said, he works for CNC Custom Designs, but I'm not giving you the phone number. You got to look it up yourself. And I was kind of hoping to make a little bit of amends to Ray, if he was here for that. But he did. He looked it up or called information or something and got through. And it's nice to be here. When I tell you that I'm a real alcoholic, I try to keep it as simple as I can because I'm an intellectual. Actually, I'm a pseudo-intellectual. I think that I'm an intellectual. And I do a lot of thinking about things and stuff, And where it says in the third paragraph of the third chapter, we alcoholics are men and women who have lost the ability to control our drinking. We know that no real alcoholic ever recovers control. You see, that's how I base my identification when I identify as a real alcoholic in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's not to be cute or funny. I'm sure you're a real alcoholic, and And quite frankly, there's nothing in our traditions, literature, anything else, anywhere else that tells us how we have to identify. Try that one on. Concepts, warranties, or any place that tells us that we have to identify as an alcoholic, even, really. Just not there. It's become tradition, with a small t, you know, by common practice and so forth. So I identify that way as a real alcoholic as a reminder to me that, because what I had to do was prove to myself that I'd lost the ability to control and enjoy my drinking. Doctors could not convince me. By the way, I'm a product of a treatment facility, and I don't apologize to anybody in this room for that. I was too arrogant, egotistical, that I would not have walked in off of the streets into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'll explain that to you in a little more detail if I have some time about my attitude at my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank God that I wound up in a treatment facility that had meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I got some initiation that way. And then twice a week, they took us to meetings outside. And so I got introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous, not really because I needed it, you know. But what I had to do over a period of, after going through that treatment facility, over a period of almost 3 years, what this alcoholic had to do was prove it to himself that I was an alcoholic. A doctor could not tell me that, as much respect as I had for doctors. In fact, I had been a pre-med student, wanted to be a doctor. I wanted to be Christian Bernard. I wanted to do the first heart transplant. You know, that was all, and you know, I'd gone to school and studied for that. Didn't work out. But I, you know, and therapists, I've been around therapists for years. I've been a psychiatric technician at one time in my life, a licensed psychiatric technician with the state of California. Worked in one of the state's finest laughing academies, Napa State Hospital. And so I wasn't about to accept the word of any therapist who didn't have my expertise and my intelligence that I was an alcoholic. In other words, when I finally wound up in that place, the treatment facility, I could tell you honestly, this is about how honest I could get, and that is that, yeah, my drinking, I've been overshooting the mark on a relatively consistent basis, you know, and shame on me. You know what I mean? I mean, I knew that that was wrong. You shouldn't be doing that. I mean, and I had been over drinking. That kind of explained to you how that really fits into my story. By the way, I'm just a beer drinker. That's all I drank. So if there's anybody here harboring any thoughts about when it's 105 and you're mowing the lawn, you know, a little cold, tall, sweaty, 16-ounce Coors is really not an answer. I don't want you to have your tongues hanging out thinking about that, but I'm sorry. This thing still thinks about it when it's hot like that and I'm mowing the lawn. Jeez, I think, God, my Coors would be good. It would just really cut the phlegm out of the throat and be so refreshing and bubbly, you know. And I tell the head, thank you. Go in and get a glass of iced tea, come back out, and, you know, get sugar-coated in my throat, and, you know, go ahead and mow the lawn and get another day of sobriety. But anyway, what had happened, I'd been overshooting this mark on a rather consistent basis. And around the 1st of December, young lady that I was married to asked me, would you cut down on your drinking? Now, nobody had ever suggested that I stop drinking. Nobody had ever suggested that. I was not a bar drinker. I was a home drinker. I fancied myself as somewhat of a Lothario and a lover. You know, I think a lot of us have had those grandiose ideas. Probably couldn't have done anything, you know. But what she said was, why don't you cut down on your drinking? You really need to. And, you know, and I, you know, not having burned out all the brain cells, I allowed us how that is not probably a bad idea, because I really had been. What I had done is I had started kind of compromising my principles. Let me give you a snapshot of my typical day. In December of 1979, My typical day at that time was I would get up in the morning, walk past the refrigerator, reach in and grab a tall, cold, sweaty, 16-ounce Coors, go in and pop that top, sit on the couch, and begin my day. Now, I was not a pig and a guzzler or anything like that, but I would drink that six-pack and then drink another six-pack. And by this time, I had learned something about peach-flavored brandy. And some guy had taught me this on a camping trip, that when you're up at about 10 or 11,000 feet and you're freezing your ass off at night, and you have been getting prepared for bed all day drinking beer, a peach-flavored brandy just before you go to bed puts a warm... I mean, the beer got me where I wanted to go, you know what I mean? But the peach-flavored brandy would just top it off, and what a warm glow. So what I was doing was drinking two six-packs, and then I would have about a half a glass of peach-flavored brandy, and then I would go in and take a nap. And then when I was rested and had finished my nap, I would get up, come back in, walk past the refrigerator, reach in and get a tall, cold, 16-ounce, sweaty Coors. Pop the top, go in, sit down on the couch, and start preparing for the evening and for bed. And that's the way my day was going at this time, you know, when she suggested I might want to cut down on my drinking. And I wasn't bothering anybody. I wasn't helping anybody. I wasn't bothering anybody. I was just in my own world, you know, and that's just what was going on. So anyway, it came down to December 23rd, and, you know, I got up that morning, walked past the refrigerator, and thought, no. And I went in and sat down on that couch without getting a drink. And I said, you know, you promised this lady you would cut down on your drinking, and you have not done that. You have not kept your word to this lady. And, you know, if you're a guy like me, your word means an awful lot, you know, particularly if you've had a rational discussion and come to some agreement that you will do certain things. And besides, it's a lady that I love and live with and that sort of a thing. And I said, well, I'm just not going to drink today. That was not a good decision. Because, and don't tell me that alkies don't have willpower, because I didn't drink that day, and relief was only 15 feet away. I was going to keep my word. I wasn't going to drink. That's the price I was going to pay for not cutting down. 4 hours later, I thought I was dying, and I came down with alcoholic paralysis. I couldn't get up off of the couch. I couldn't, you know. I mean, this part of me up here was moving. This part down here didn't even know it existed. You know what I mean? And I just, you know, and I thought about, geez, if I roll off of this couch, maybe I can crawl and do some stuff or something, you know, and I was scared to do that. Jesus Christ, what if I get down there and can't get back up, you know? And so she had been out Christmas shopping, spending my hard-earned money, wasting it, trying to impress people who don't care, and all that stuff. You know, I got more important things to do. And she got home, and she took one look at me, and she knew I was in trouble. We called the family doctor, and the doctor says, well, bring him in tomorrow, first thing in the morning. I'll take a look at him and see what we can do. What I'm telling you is I had to go through that garbage all night long, through that withdrawal, you know, and then got in to see the doctor the next morning. You know what he did? He just took one look at me and says, you go over to community hospitals. They have an alcohol rehabilitation center over there. And get checked in, and went over, got checked in. Now, I got to tell you something. That quack could have sent me over there the day before, you know, but he let me suffer all that night. It's probably one of the best blessings because, you know, in a treatment center, what they do, and particularly in medical treatment, they detox you with Librium, you know, and it kind of takes away some of the pain. But, you know, again, what happens and what I... something that became extremely important to me later in retrospect because of my history, and then I'll just briefly go through a little bit of that, was later I forgot how painful that day had been, how I, honest to God, thought I was dying and winding up in there. Now remember, I'm not an alcoholic. I'm in there for R&R and medical treatment, and, you know, because I'm the type of drunk, when I drink, I don't eat for 2 weeks at a time. Never made sense to me to screw up a real good drunk with food, you know. And Diane would fix wonderful dinners and stuff like that. So anyway, what took place was that I got in there and I went through that the program, if you will, and I graduated magna cum laude, highest honors, you know, because I do programs good. You know, I've taught college for 8 years prior to this. I've been a lieutenant with the Fresno Police Department for almost 20 years. You know, I am somebody in this goddamn community. You know what I mean? And if you are in those kind of disciplines, you know how to do programs. You know how to read, study, and say the right things. Doesn't matter what you believe in here, you know. Now you say, well, what did you do when you went to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous? I mean, well, what the hell? You think I'm going to sit in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and say, I'm Bill and I'm a Texan? Christ, no. Everybody says, I'm Bill and I'm an alcoholic. You know what I mean? You say that stuff. It sticks in your throat. It makes you want to puke when you're not an alky. What you've done is just simply overshot the mark for a period of time, and you're recuperating and resting. So I go through the program. I got to tell you, you want to know how good I did in that program? When I graduated from that Academy of Higher Learning, they even gave my co-alcoholic a medallion for graduation. First time in the history of that place they'd ever done that. I know that I was going to be their star example in the community, you know. This, city employee that had been involved in a lot of politics and was somebody as a teacher, and he's going to be the guy they're going to hold. You know, I mean, oh, Jesus, what an ego, you know. I mean, I had this all figured out. They were going to hold me up to an example and make millions of dollars off of the fact that they got me sober. Now, they said some really weird stuff in this treatment facility. One thing they said is, if you're an alcoholic, you can't drink. Pardon? Excuse me? I didn't hear the alcoholic part because that wasn't applicable to me, you know. They said, you know, you can't drink. Now, I'm intelligent. I'm somebody in this community. I read the newspapers. I watch the news broadcast on television. I look at insurance tables. And I know that I've got another 25 years to live, statistically. And what that lady was telling me is that I was not going to be able to have a drink for 25 years. See, that's how my head worked on that. She said something else that was really ludicrous. She said, when you get out of here, you ought to go to 4 or 5 meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous a week. Now, come on, I've got a lot of polish and a lot of class and a lot of education. And I don't intentionally hurt people. I'm a gentleman and so forth. And not only that, but I understand that this lady's had a little bit of college, you know, and she's working there, so she must know something. I mean, I can still hook up some ideas. But I looked that gal right straight in the eyes, really. I looked her right straight in the eyes with all the empathy that you can look at another human. And I said to her, you obviously don't know who I am. You know, I've got places to go, people to see, and things to do. I can't be in 4 or 5 goddamn meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous a week, you know. Now, you just know with that attitude that I was destined to skyrocket to stardom in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. I mean, looking back on some of this, I said, you're working here and employed and making a salary and a living and so forth. You must have a little knowledge. And I says, I think that probably I can go to one meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous a week. And I really won't be real pleased about that. But I'll do it. And I kept my word to her. I went to three meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, 3 weeks in a row, a meeting a week, got a resentment, and never went back, you know, until 9 months later. But I stayed sober. You see, the Catholics have the right idea. If you screw up, do penance, you know. 10,000 Hail Marys and a whole bunch of squeeze of grapes or whatever they do, you know, the bead stuff, you know. I mean, but, and they got it from the ancients, you know what I mean? This idea of confessing one's sins and then, you know, paying a penalty and a price for it. And I, you know, that was a logical thing to me. I had been overshooting the mark. And I didn't have insurance. Policemen, can you believe that? We didn't have insurance for treatment for alcoholism. Damn garbage men in Fresno could get treatment for alcoholism, but not cops. You can't have alcoholic cops. So there was no need for us to have, you know. So I had to pay for that treatment myself, you know, out of my own savings and stuff. And, you know, and this was kind of the attitude that I had. So, okay, it's a lot of family money that's gone into this. And I truthfully had been overshooting the mark, and I'm in pretty good shape now. I mean, God, what else? I mean, if you eat three meals a day and suck up vitamins like crazy and get some rest, take care of yourself, get out and start playing golf, you know, and being part of life, you get in pretty good shape, you know, really. May come as a surprise to some of you folks, you know, but, and I was in pretty good shape, and I didn't keep my word to her. And I really had been screwing up, and it doesn't look good for a lieutenant with a Fresno Police Department to be a drunk, you know, and doing the stuff that I was doing. So I said, you know, really, I should pay a penance, and I shouldn't drink for a while. I mean, it made sense to me. Not 25 goddamn years, I'll assure you, but I shouldn't drink for a while, you know. We'll wait and kind of see how this goes. And it was 4.5 months later. They had the biggest social function of the year for the Fresno Police Department. It was the biggest deal. And what it was an excuse for the wives to go out and spend hard-earned policemen's money on brand new dresses. There'd be 400 or 500 people attend these things, really. You know, they were dressy affairs, live music, absolute best food. You know what I mean? Retirement stuff and, you know, gold watches and all that stuff. And it was a real special occasion. And I had always loved those. Because there's a bond between cops. There really is. There's a bond, you know, and particularly when you spend all your life with people and you've had to depend upon them, they've had to depend upon you and so forth. So there's a bond when these guys retire, and it was an extremely important social function. And so she went out and did what I said, you know, wasted money on a beautiful, oh no, she looked beautiful. She wasn't wasted. She looked gorgeous. But as she was getting dressed that night, and as I was getting into my three-piece suit, I did not look at her. But I did make the rather casual announcement that I think I'm going to have a drink tonight. Well, it's about time, you know. I hadn't had any drink for 4.5 months. And there isn't a thing that cops do that doesn't have booze attached to it. I don't know about the social circle or career that you came from, but that's just the way we are, you know. And I didn't want to look at her face. I didn't want to see the reaction. I'm the man. I think I'll have a drink tonight and see how that goes. It never made sense to me because it had never been my experience that it's the first drink that gets you drunk. That is just crass garbage for ignorant people. I had never gotten drunk in my life on one drink. So I'm going to try a drink tonight, see how that goes, you know. Now you got to follow this a little bit. I mean, God, it works in some weird ways, but all of this weirdness is in retrospect. It wasn't really awful funny at the time it was happening. But so we go, and I order a bourbon and 7. Now, you know, I told you I was a beer drinker. And I told you that I had compromised my principles, learning how to put the glow on where I was, you know what I mean, with the brandy. But now at a nice social function, you can't drink a tall, cold, 16-ounce Coors. It is a demonstration of a lack of class. What you drink is a mixed drink, which is what people with class drink. You know, they don't drink beer. And so I ordered a bourbon and seven. And I'm having fun talking to guys and, you know, and all this stuff that we do. We dance, we eat, and all that stuff. And I order another bourbon and seven. I didn't get drunk. I didn't slur my words. I didn't puke on the floor. I didn't embarrass myself. In fact, I was socializing quite well, thank you. And second one. Now, I'm sitting there with this second one in front of me, socializing, enjoying, and I mean, this is what life is about. It's about life, you know? And some gal that I'd known in the police department for 20 years come toddling over. And I'm sitting here, you know, and spreading my wisdom around, and she comes over and kneels down beside me. Listen to this. You want to screw up a good evening? You know what she said to me? And I got this bourbon and seven right here. She says, I understand you just got out of treatment. I know firsthand how it's just terrible trying to drink and socialize and have fun and have somebody, you know, it's the old thing about a head full of AA and a belly full of booze. I know the feeling. Jesus. And then the corker, I'm sitting here trying now to get this damn bourbon and seven away, you know, and act like it's somebody else's. And I mean, she's kneeling right here, and we're, you know, we're chatting and so forth. And then she told me she'd been a member of Alcoholics Anonymous for 12 years. And that just really did me in. Finally, I was able to get rid of her and go ahead and have two more drinks in peace and quiet, feeling guilty as hell, you know, for some reason. And that's the way it started me. So I had four drinks that night. Nothing happened. I didn't get drunk. I got to tell you, I didn't like drunks. I mean, I didn't like people getting drunk. I had some kind of special attachment to drunks on the street. Isn't that weird? I mean, I arrested a lot of derelicts. But you know what my motive was? And this is only in retrospect. I really didn't think about it too much other than to verbalize it. But it was, you know, here's some guy that's all soused up on alcohol. I mean, you know, typical, what an alcoholic should look like. Not like me, sophisticated. But, you know, down and out drunk, down on South G Street for you guys, you know, Skid Row. And, but my whole thing was not just necessarily to get him off the street, but if I get him in jail, he's going to go to road camp, he's going to get food for 30 days, he's going to get a chance to clean up, shower, shave, and, you know, be taken care of. You know, and I don't know where that comes from. You know, but there was some kind of a kinship. But I got to tell you, when I was at parties and people got drunk, I was really disgusted. I just thought out of control was not proper behavior for people. Anyway, not to drag this out any longer than necessary, I went out and played golf a couple of weeks later, and on the 19th hole, I had a bourbon and seven again. And I didn't, what I want to tell you is that I didn't puke on the floor. I didn't get drunk. I didn't slur my words. I didn't slide under the table. I didn't embarrass myself. And I went home. The next week, I went out to the country club. We were members at Belmont. And played another round of golf. And on the 19th hole, went into the clubhouse and had two bourbon and sevens. I didn't slur my words, puke on the floor, slide under the table, didn't embarrass myself, and went home. No problem. The next week, went out, played 18 holes of golf, and on the 19th hole, went into the clubhouse, sat down, and had three bourbon and sevens, and bought a six-pack on the way home, and was off to the damn races. And wound up 4.5 months later back in that same treatment facility in those Christian Dior designer split-back pajamas in which they put drunks to humiliate us. You know what I mean? With paper sandals. Me, you know. And I mean, I was just really humiliated. Now, this is 9.5 months after I've gotten out and graduated magna cum laude and so forth. And the chief had told me originally, he said, I was scared to death I was going to get fired. You know, you just can't have alcoholic cops. I mean, Christ, it's unheard of, you know, we can't do that. I was the first officer ever in Fresno County to go through treatment, publicly acknowledged. You know, I mean, that everybody knew about. There may have been some others before, they were quiet. And so when I wound up in this in for detox, well, first of all, I went in on Friday, planned this pretty good, because this way then I could detox over the weekend, okay? Follow the logic. Alcoholics are not stupid. You know, follow the logic, and then I could show up for work Monday. And then I could get out on Sunday, and I could go play golf. On Sunday, when it was time to get out, I called Diana, and I says, bring the clubs. I'm ready. And, geez, do we have any beer at home? No. Well, we better buy some. I mean, the insanity is when you get out of detox and you want a six-pack, you know, stop and buy a six-pack and start... But I had no comprehension. ...of alcoholism, even though I'd been through treatment, because of my attitude and my feelings about it. And besides that, for Christ's sakes, it was only beer. You know what I mean? I've been a pre-med student. I knew that you could not become alcoholic on beer. Now, people who drink Kentucky bourbon become alcoholics. People who drink vodka are pinko commies. They're no good, you know. And people get in trouble drinking that stuff. But beer, uh-uh, you know. Jeez. Now, what I want to do is kind of skip forward a little bit, because otherwise I'll keep you here all night. But I was trying to regain that control. That's why I identify as a real alcoholic. We alcoholics are men and women who have lost the ability to control our drinking. We know that no real alcoholic ever recovers control. I am a lieutenant with the Fresno Police Department, a career law enforcement officer with a lot of education, absolutely worthless the way I was using it. You know what I mean? And so, I mean, it just wasn't doing me any good at this stage of my life and so forth. And I just had so many problems. But what happened was that I wanted to control that and just enjoy it. I didn't want to get drunk. I wanted to be sophisticated, enjoy it, mow the lawn, have the beer, and do that stuff, you know, and be able to go out with the guys occasionally, you know, and with my comrades or the guys that work for me and stuff. And have a couple of beers. And I wound up back in detox centers several more times. And then one day, I don't know what it was. I cannot explain it to you, because when I detox hard. I told you about the alcoholic paralysis, okay? And how I was just totally incapacitated. I got up one day, and I mean, God was in heaven. The skies were blue, the birds were singing, my pool was full, the yard work was done, I was at peace with the world. This is about the fifth time, or sixth time. And I said to myself, self, this is wonderful. We're not going to drink today. And I didn't drink, and I didn't go through detox. Now, you tell me how that's possible when you detox like I do, as hard as I do, and so forth. Now, follow my logic and my thinking on this. I did not go through withdrawal or detox, whatever you prefer. I had absolutely no symptoms. I was at peace with the world. Everything was okay, and what have you. And I did not drink and had no problem. Went to bed that night, went to sleep, which was always a fear of mine and Dr. Bob's, was not being able to go to sleep. And got up the next day, God was in heaven, skies were blue, butterflies were flitting around, birds were singing, and I mean, all this stuff, you know. And I didn't drink that day. Didn't have any problem with it. Did stuff around the house, ate a little bit, and did some stuff. And this went on, and then it got down to the 11th day. And I think the only way to really get a guy sober is to give him a lobotomy or something. I mean, Jesus. You know, it seems at times. But this thing got to thinking. And I finally came to the conclusion, I got this figured out. If you get up with the right attitude after a night of drinking, if everything is okay and it's peaceful and you get up with the right attitude, then you don't have to drink and there won't be a problem. Now, I want you to follow the alcoholic's logic. This is 11 days without a drink. Well, I have found the answer. If I can stop drinking and not have a problem, I might as well start. Because if I get in trouble with it, I'll just quit. I got to tell you, when I eventually got to step two, folks, I began to understand insanity. You know, when you got reasoning that's as screwed up as mine, and so forth. And so I went to the store and I got a six-pack. I mean, might as well. What the hell? I'd like to have a beer or two once in a while. What are you laughing at? And I had two beers that evening. I didn't get drunk. You see, now it's coming into focus that these people in their treatment center lied. You know? And I know. Now that you know, you know. You know what I mean? I mean, oh, geez. It's a miracle I'm standing before you today. It really is. And so I had those two beers. I went to bed and I went to sleep. And I got a good night's rest. And I got up the next morning and I had a cup of coffee and then went in and let's have a beer. I drank those four and went back for more. And one more time, you know, I was off to the races. But now, you know, I have an idea of what's going on. You know, I'll just get up happy. Jesus, never did that again. And I don't understand. I guess a doctor would call that a phenomenon of some sort. Because I had no physical suffering or any of that stuff. It's just crazy. So then it was necessary for me to go on and wind up in hospitals and stuff in places again. Actually, a total of 8 times in a little less than the next 3 years. But here's the thing that happened to me. The last time that I went into treatment was October the 29th, 1982. And I pray to God as sincerely as I can that I will never have to go into another hospital, another treatment facility, or take another drink. And I believe that there's a good chance I may not have to. You know what I mean? Today. But I went back in there on October the 29th, 1982. One of the things I sometimes talk about is the fact that I'm kind of a unique alcoholic because I can tell you exactly when I became an alcoholic. And let me describe when. Now, you guys all passed some fuzzy line. Okay? Not me. I know precisely within an hour of when I became an alcoholic. What had happened, I'd just been in the hospital with alcoholic pneumonia now, because again, I told you I don't eat, I don't take care of myself, in a hospital for pneumonia. And they damn near killed me by hitting me with morphine and turned me 9 colors. I mean, it was a painful experience. And I get out of the hospital after 2 weeks, and I'm in pretty good shape, bought beer on the way home. I mean, that's what you do, right? If there's no beer at home, you buy some on the way home. Jesus. And started drinking. In about 3 days, it started hurting for me to drink. And but the mind, in addition to giving you some bad information from time to time, also can sometimes recall some information. And I recalled from almost 3 years before a thing called esophageal varices when I'd gone through that treatment facility. That's where the arteries come into the esophagus, and with alcoholics, we wear that thin and it's not uncommon for us, for those to rupture, and if that happens, you bleed out like a stuck pig internally. You may be able to spit a little bit of it up, but it's going to get you in here. And you best have your tail on a gurney in the operating room, because you can bend over and kiss your bippy goodbye, you know. I mean, it just kills people when you start bleeding out, because there's just no way to get there unless they're right on top of it. You know what I mean? You're gone. And after about 3 or 4 days, this began playing on my mind. In those moments of clarity in between the runs and the drinks, and a little bit of kind of sobriety. Yeah, well, it's not sobriety, but I mean, you know, that moment of clarity. You know what I'm trying to say. And I thought, you know, sucker, I think you have just about taken this to the edge. You have ridden this horse just about as far as you can take it. You are dying. You see, what this guy had to do, because of my career and my orientation, is prove it to me. And now, almost 3 years later, what I had done was, with the pain, with the esophageal varices and thinking about it, I knew that my moment had come. Now, I was drinking a beer, had made my run to the store to get another case, because she was going to be going to work at 2 o'clock. And so I had one going, went and got, you know, got my emergency supplies before she left, and was working on one out of that thing, and was had a third one going, and finally she got up and left and went to work. You know, and at that point I picked up the phone and I called that treatment facility and said, would you please come pick me up? And that was at about 2 o'clock in the afternoon on October the 29th, 1982, and at that time I became an alcoholic. You see, when I made the call, not doctors, not wives, not anybody else, not AA or anything else, but when I picked up that phone and made the call, that was step one, you know. And I knew she was going to kill me and so forth, but that wasn't the case. She wanted to kill me because, again, we didn't have insurance and it was going to mean another $10,000, you know. But hell, I mean, in 10 years of dresses, we'd cover that much. So hell, I'm worth 10. No. So what I got to tell you about that is, when I went back in that day, I went back in with an entirely different attitude than I had had almost 3 years before. And it's amazing what happens when your attitude changes. Isn't that what the whole spiritual experiencing about is, change? I mean, if you read that in the back of the big book, it's about change of personality. So, you know, I'd really met my Waterloo, went back in there with a change of attitude. Second night, they were having an AA meeting, and I'm still detoxing. I'm still in the detox unit. Now, take this guy who had this contempt prior to investigation of Alcoholics Anonymous. Let him take step one and be sitting there detoxing in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm looking at these people. They're smiling, laughing, hugging, playing grab ass. You know, I mean, the stuff we do in meetings, you know. And it seemed to be enjoying life. And I got to tell you, when you're detoxing, there is nothing funny in your life, you know. And I'm sitting here watching this picture, and I have to admit that Alcoholics Anonymous shows results. Doesn't the book say something like prodigious results? Now, I'm looking at these people that almost 3 years before I had utter contempt for, and I'm thinking to myself, these people are staying sober, and what's even more important, they're laughing and enjoying it, and they're clean. And you know, and again, I didn't eat for 2 weeks. I didn't bathe for 2 weeks. I mean, that takes a lot of effort to bathe, you know, and stuff. What I had to do at that time was take, what I did at that time, looking around that room, was take step two. And my step two was coming to believe that Alcoholics Anonymous could work. The evidence was here, the people laughing, having a good time, and sober. The evidence was right there in front of me. It was irrefutable. And I wasn't sure that it could work for me. I just wasn't sure. So, you know, the the sad thing about it is, though, that there weren't as many as there had been almost 3 years before. You know, that's the nature of the disease of alcoholism. It's a killer. So, you know, a lot of people had to go out and do the things that I was doing, and they died, you know. They didn't make it back. I still don't have an answer to this day, and I don't want an answer to this day. I just know that I'm sober. Well, why me? But again, taking step two and asking them, how do you, you know, they would say stupid, dumb stuff like, God does this. Oh, well, how do you get God to do this stuff? They said, well, you pray. I says, oh, that crap doesn't work. You know, not only had I been a pre-med student, but that was 14 years in parochial school. I got to tell you, folks, I could pray prayers in church that the congregation would just levitate out the door on a spiritual high. That doesn't work. I mean, it was like the Sadducees and the Pharisees, you know. I mean, it just meant nothing. But, you know, when you're desperate enough, you'll try. You take steps one and two, and you don't know where else to go, and they say you better pray. So what I did was I waited for my roommate to get clear at the other end of that treatment facility, and I went into my room and shut the door because I didn't want him to see me as important as I am on my knees talking to somebody that's not there. I damn sure did not want a staff member to walk by an open door seeing somebody as important as me on my knees talking to somebody when they're there. They'd put me on 4 West, which is where they put the nutcases, you know what I mean? I mean, this was my muddled thinking. But you know, if you're desperate enough, what you will do is you will do what is necessary. And I got on my knees and I got down and uttered the most beautiful prayer in the world. Some of you have uttered the same prayer. God help me, I can't take it anymore. I just can't do it. You know, I didn't have a bunch of wherefores, whereases, therefores, and all that crap that, you know, that you hear in church prayers. It was a prayer of desperation. I have ridden this horse, I'm on the razor's edge, and I'm going to fall off. And God help me. That, you cannot get a more sincere prayer than a prayer of that kind of desperation. Now, I wish I could tell you that I'd had Bill Wilson's blinding flash. I had been a hard case, and sobriety was not going to come easy either. And so what I had to do, when I got up, I had this feeling that it's going to be okay. I did have that kind of a feeling. And I sometimes wonder, with newcomers particularly, I wonder if you and I really have the right to expect anything more than okay out of sobriety. There's people that seem to think you're just going to become absolutely wonderful, magnificent. All, some of us, that may happen. And, you know, but, you know, I'm really content today to be okay. That's not a bad deal, considering where I came from. You know what I mean? And so it's been that way. And I did all the things they said to get a sponsor, you know. I don't know where they get those animals, but I got one. And I just want to close with a real quick story. It's time to wrap this up. And a meeting that starts on time and ends on time is a good meeting. Charlie told me some things to do. And I thought, I mean, a sponsor is God. I mean, that's the crap you hear in meetings, you know. And I got myself a sponsor, and I bird-dogged him a while. I didn't have the guts to walk up to him and ask him, Charlie, would you be my sponsor? I got his phone number and called him and whined and sniveled, Charlie, would you be my sponsor? God knew he was going to reject me, and one more time, you know, all that insecurity and stuff, because I'm desperate. And he said, sure. We got together and met, and he laid out the conditions under which he'd sponsor me. Now, what I want to tell you about that, and the reason I really mentioned it, I've had 2 other sponsors since Charlie, because I believe in sponsorship. I've also had 3 service sponsors, because I got involved in general service. But what Charlie got drunk. You want to try a trip, be 18 months sober, and have your sponsor get drunk. I got to tell you something that is absolute, utter nuts-making. And I really began to doubt and to wonder what this was all about. I really did. And thank God that I went to a lot of meetings and talked to a lot of people. But you know, even though Charlie got drunk, you know, Charlie gave me the gift of life. You know what I mean? He told me the things to do, gave me the instructions I needed, and was there for me. Why Charlie had to go get drunk, I don't know. But he gave me the gift of life. And I do remember one thing Charlie used to say, and it was something that turned out to be not true, but he said, stay out of general service, that's politics. At about 3 years sober, I got involved in it. And to make a long story short, I want to tell you, standing before you is the epitome of Herbert Spencer's quotation in the Big Book. There is a principle which is a bar against all information, proof against all argument, and cannot fail to keep a man in everlasting ignorance. That principle is contempt prior to investigation. Now, take this guy that was full of that contempt, and I told you about how I didn't stand a chance of skyrocketing to stardom in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I still haven't. But you know what's happened with this guy? This guy has got to be delegate to New York. You know, about 3 years later, got into general service, started doing the things I needed to do in general service. The Oxford groups, I've been to the Reverend Shoemaker's church. I've been in his church. I've been in the Calvary Mission where the Oxford groups were in New York. I've been at T. Henry and Clarice Williams' home in Akron where Dr. Bob went to the Akron groups. Now I get to come to Stockton and be with the Oxford group. I mean, it's a miracle. Who would believe that this guy that came to you, you know, a little over 11 and a half years ago, would wind up and be able to go to those places? I've been in a room where Bill was born, you know, and I've been to his gravesite. And I mean, it's just fabulous. Me, the guy full of contempt, simply by trying to follow 12 things that are not always easy. Not real difficult, but not always easy to do. And then putting 12 more things in my life, becoming familiar with these things that hold this thing together, and then learning about some other stuff like concepts and warranties, and I get to go to New York and be with the giants of Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, I love this fellowship. And I got to go and be your representative back there in your voice for 2 years. And God, I love you all for it, and it's a real miracle. So, one more time, I would like to tell you, thank you for having me here. I'd like to share a little bit more about the actual process of recovery, but, you know, again, a meeting that ends on time is a good one. So, thank you for my life, and thank you for letting me come here tonight and share with you. Thank you.
Let's give Bill another hand. Okay, we'll have, I talked to Ray Tuesday, and he's got a speaker lined up for next week. He had his first meeting up in Oxford, too, met in Red Bluff Monday night for their first meeting, and they had 45 people at their first. See y'all next week, and we'll close in the usual manner.